Thanks for tuning into Journey. Everyone is welcome at the table. We are a community being shaped by Jesus, experiencing and practicing humility, curiosity, belonging, and generosity. We hope to be a people who embrace the way of Jesus by listening first, speaking second, loving freely, and giving generously.
We're going to start today by answering some questions we didn't get to from last week. Kevin, does a great job responding to everybody who texts in questions. But we also do a podcast every week that responds to questions that we get. In this case, there were some we just wanted to highlight kind of in this space. So we're going to start with them and then dive into our text this morning. So fire up the questions, if you would, Sarah. Number one, what genre should we consider Genesis 1 to be? Now, do you guys know what genre is? Right? Genre is the kind of literature. And one of the major, major points we made when we, and we continue to make, as we talk about what the Bible is and how we approach it, is that we often approach the Bible as if it were like one book, and it is to be read the same way the whole way through, instead of approaching it as if it were a library or a Barnes & Noble bookstore where there are all sorts of different genres. The problem is the types of literature aren't marked out for us. So it's not like it'll say, hey, you're coming to historical narrative here, or mythic poetry, or parable here, or apocalyptic literature, prophetic literature. You just kind of don't know that. And so the temptation, at least growing up, was just to read the Bible as if it were to be read the same way the whole way through. So this is a really insightful question, because how you answer what is Genesis? What genre is it? Is it science? Is it history? Is it mythic poetry? What is it? Well, to a great degree, determine on how you interpret it down the road. I'm going to postpone the answer to that question, because I want to just approach the text as it's coming to us, and then we'll see along the way what it's getting at. And you know, not shockingly, I don't think that Moses was trying to answer the question, hey, how old is the universe, when he wrote Genesis 1. I think he was answering a bunch of different questions. And so we'll get to those as we move on. Great question. Next. Why didn't translators use what appears to be a simple Hebrew translation? Remember, last week we looked at the first sentence, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and we noticed that heavens and earth, what comes to my brain in the 21st century is vastly different than what the Hebrew author would have meant by heaven and earth. And the translation we suggested was earth just means the stuff down here, and the heavens mean the skies up there. And so in the beginning, God created the what's here and what's up there. And when did he do it? Well, he did it in the beginning, which in English, again, sounds like a very definitive point in time that unleashes some sort of chronology. But as we looked at last week, Rishit, the word for beginning, and must be pronounced very carefully, stands for a preliminary period of time that the author just wants to kind of get out of the way. Similar to like when we say, hey, once upon a time, then this happened. All of this should be review, hopefully. So the question becomes, well, how come this isn't always reflected in the translations that we have in English? And translations the translators have an immensely difficult job, because not only are we learning more and more about the Hebrew worldview and the ancient Near East, but English words change over time. And so heaven didn't always mean a post-mortem place you go where you die. Heavens meant the skies back in the day. So I think the translators do a phenomenal job, but they can't always capture, I mean, for those of you that travel internationally, you know when you step into another culture, you're not playing by English rules anymore, right? You're not playing by how the English language works, or right? I mean, we can have Google Translate, or we can have other things that will help us, but that doesn't give us comprehension. We may be able to piece a sentence together very poorly, but that doesn't help us understand what exactly it is they're talking about. And so one of the things that we're going to continually hold up throughout this whole conversation around Genesis is how much we import our 21st century American worldview into a 3,000 or 4,000-year-old document, and how we have to unlearn that practice in order to really hear what it's saying. So I think the translations are okay. The one thing we did point out last week is when we translate "in the beginning," there's no "the" there in Hebrew. It just says "in beginning." And, you know, that does kind of make potentially a difference in how you understand what that beginning period is. So there is no such thing as a simple Hebrew translation. Hebrew is brutal, and that's why none of us have studied it. So we're thankful for all the work that goes into English Bibles. Next. Kevin, tell me Mike has at least 7 black shirts, 7 brown shorts, and several flip-flops. Okay. Well, I know, but why are you being asked this question? First of all, how would you know? Right? Kevin and I are close, but he's not gone through my closet. You know? I mean, we're not there yet. And just in case you're wondering, I have 1 pair of black flip-flops, 1 pair of brown shorts, and 2 black shirts. I only wear this on Sunday. Seriously, this is my dress-up outfit, and I only wear it Sunday. So, guess it'll go in the wash today. It will be prepared like the high priestly garments in the Old Testament for next Sunday. That's it. Do we need more American consumers? No. Susie told me, this is called what? A modular wardrobe, a capsule wardrobe, which I don't know what that means, but I guess it means like you realize life is more important than food and clothing. Next. I know. We won't always start our services with this. Let me tell you that. Who is the author of Genesis? Great question. Historically, Moses is attributed as the author of Genesis. But the problem, again, is what Americans mean by authorship and what Hebrews would mean by authorship are 2 totally different things. So when we say Moses is the author of Genesis, we think we mean Moses just penned Genesis 1, handed it to the scribe and said, okay, make 1 billion copies of this and we're good. There's no doubt the Torah originated with Moses. And so in that sense, he is like the source or the start of Torah. But how the Old Testament came together is really interesting, really human, really complicated, and therefore beautiful. And so, yes, he's the author, but not maybe in the Hebrew text that we have. He's the author of a Hebrew text or a series of oral traditions that then got codified and moved into relationship with other pieces in the Hebrew Bible. Like a narrator? I don't know that I would use the word narrator here, because narrator implies he had this omniscient view and was just sort of, you know, God was showing him what was happening and he was just writing it down. I would rather think Moses is a bit of a translator, taking the thought forms of the Hebrew Bible and the ancient Near Eastern world of which he is a part, and then revealing Yahweh through those in very true and real ways. And we'll get to that in a second. Great, 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 great. Next. Okay, last one. With Genesis 1:1 saying, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And if the original contextual Hebrew understanding was that heavens and the earth meant what's up there and what's down here, what was the likely belief / interpretation of the original hearers of God's creation of the spiritual realm? Does heaven and earth mean all that is, including the spiritual realm, all of creation? Or would the original hearers believe that God created all that is physically, but the spiritual realms were already existent? What a great question, and we'll get to it. So all that buildup was, it's coming. Short answer, absolutely. They didn't differentiate in the way the physical and spiritual is differentiated in us. Right? So for us, we make a very hard and fast line between what's spiritual and what's like material. I don't think they had that same way of understanding it, and that's part of our problem. All right. That's last week. Here's this week. Fire up Genesis 1. 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So we looked at beginning, we looked at heaven and earth. The next word in our sentence as we speed our way through the first sentence of the Bible is the word God. In the beginning, God. Now, this whole little teaching is going to be from the obvious school of obvious. But, so this is stuff we all know. But in Hebrew, there's a breathing mark under Elohim, the word that we translate God, which means the reader, because you would hear this, you wouldn't read this, you would hear it read, that the reader would pause. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So we wanted kind of our series to reflect that same pause. In the beginning, God. Before we rush into all the other stuff, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. So let's talk a little bit about the God that Genesis presents us with, right? So the word that's translated God here is the word Elohim. And it's a generic, and this gets confusing, it's a generic name for a deity. Tim Mackey at the Bible Project, they've settled on a phrase, spiritual being, to describe what an Elohim is. And I really like that. I think that's a great way to say that, because Elohim can also refer to angels or lesser gods in the Old Testament, like a divine council we'll explore down the road. So Elohim, and this is, again, Elohim is used in Genesis 1 as a generic name for deity that we translate God. Very similar to our English word God. You could, if I said you believe in God and you say yes, that doesn't narrow it down much. Correct? Yahweh, next slide, is the personal name of the God of Israel given to Moses, and it's used in Genesis 2 when we read about God. So there must be a reason why Elohim is used in 1 and Yahweh is used in 2, because clearly the author of Genesis had both available and chose specifically to use Elohim first. So Sarah, back if you would, one slide to Elohim. This word is, it is a noun that's put in the plural. The I am there says it's a plural word. And that's because it's a noun of majesty. It's something that happens throughout the Old Testament and the ancient world, where you would take a noun and you would place it in the plural to, so it's almost like a royal, like when the royal we, when the king or queen of England says, let us, or we, like that's a plural of majesty. And Elohim, because it's a plural, whenever it's followed by a singular verb, I know, guys, look at me. You love this. When it's followed by a singular verb, it's in reference to capital God, the Elohim. When it's followed by plural verbs, it means the gods or the spiritual beings, of which Yahweh is one, all right? So monotheism doesn't say there's only one spiritual being, because the Bible clearly teaches there are loads of them. Monotheism means that there's one supreme being who created everything, including the other spiritual beings. Are you with me? So Elohim is just an interesting word. It's in the plural first, and that's a plural of majesty. Secondly, it's a generic name for deity, and we'll find, if we were to take the time, which we will not today, but we'll find other beings called Elohim, but they're used that differently. So here, in the beginning, God created, singular verb, we're talking about the God, the definitive spiritual being, the spiritual being over all the spiritual beings. Are you with me? Hallelujah. All right. And the reason that word is used here and not Yahweh is because the author in Genesis 1 is trying to capture the absolute grandeur and power of this God over above everything else. Like yes, there are loads of spiritual beings in the Bible, but there's only one God like this. So we're acknowledging the category of spiritual beings, but there's only one supreme one, one that rules over all the other ones. Now, to look at how different the Bible presents Elohim versus how other creation accounts in the ancient Near East presented him, I need to set this next point up with some quotes, all right? Are you guys okay? Yeah. Okay, well, we're going anyway, so God bless us. So this is from Richard Carlson and Tremper Longman, and this is adapted from them. The early chapters of Genesis accurately present two accounts of cosmic and human origins. So Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 are two different accounts, and we'll talk about that. But they present them in the language and ideas of the ancient Hebrews. Now, this is the no-duh portion of our sermon this morning, but we don't give this the weight it deserves. That this is full of Hebrew thought forms and ancient Near Eastern concepts, none of which we're familiar with. So very naturally, we just import all of our predetermined understandings and meanings, and that's where we get tripped up. Next. These texts should not be removed from their ancient context, and they should not be read as if they refer to the process of cosmic or human origins in 21st century scientific terms. Guys, this is such a big point. When we come to Genesis, yeah, the goal is to appreciate the beauty of God, not to debate about how it happened. The author is not interested in when or how. The author is interested in what was created and why, as we talked about last week. So these accounts speak in terms of ancient Near Eastern perceptions of the world, and they should be interpreted in that setting. When we discern the meaning of the texts in their ancient context, we find that they constitute a worldview statement about God and his relationship to the world, and about humans and their relationship to God and the world. This basic worldview statement transcends its ancient cultural setting and commands the attention of God's people in all places and all times. This is the difference we talked about last week between physics and metaphysics. Physics deals with the questions about how the material order is operates, the laws by which it's governed, and the way it interacts with each other. Metaphysics talks about the big questions of meaning, purpose, significance of what was created, not just when it was or how it was. This should kind of be review. Are you okay? Okay. Two other statements, and then we'll get to a point. We're going to look at two ancient cosmological accounts, right? One from Babylon and one from Egypt. And I want to set these up by understanding what you're about to read. They do not have as their primary purpose to explain where the universe comes from. All right, next. They are intended, next sentence, I'm sorry. They are intended instead, go ahead one more, Sarah, if you would. They're intended to instead deal with basic worldview issues like the nature and purpose of the world, who are we, where are we, why are we here, and who are the gods. So I want to look at two, an Egyptian account and a Babylonian account, all right? And you're going to see similarities and differences. Today, I want to emphasize the differences between how the gods were understood by the people in Israel's neighborhood and how the Bible presents Elohim, all right? I know this is some thick stuff, but it utterly matters. When you read in the beginning, God, and pause, created the heavens and the earth, what kind of God are we talking about here? Well, the best way to answer that is to look at other ancient Near Eastern conceptions of things like Genesis 1, an origin account of the gods. And so here's the first one. God bless us. These are called coffin texts because they were literally found on a sarcophagi. Or no, singular, that would be plural. A sarcophagus. And you would read stories on a sarcophagus like this. So here's one of them, and this is a very ancient Near Eastern account. Are you ready? Okay. This one starts with waters. Now, do waters play any significant role in Genesis 1? Oh, they do. So that's going to be a point of similarity when we get to the part, that part of Genesis 1, is that that almost all the ancient Near Eastern creation accounts reference waters. The waters speak. Now, in the Egyptian context, this is the god Nun, right? Nun represents the primeval waters out of which nothing yet has come. So the waters speak, I am the waters, unique and without second. Now then we meet a tomb. A tomb speaks. That watery place we just referenced, that is where I evolved. On the great occasion of my floating that happened to me, I, Atun the Creator, am the one who once evolved, Circlet, who is in his egg. If you guys get this, you're way ahead of me. I am the one who began therein in the waters. See, the flood is subtracted from me. See, I am the remainder. I made my body evolve through my own effectiveness. I am the one who made me. I built myself as I wished according to my heart. So this account starts with waters, ancient primeval waters. That the waters themselves aren't considered a created thing. That's just an image for non-creation. And out of this evolves this god, Atum. And he floats to the top of these waters as an egg. That egg breaks open, and out of that egg, land emerges. And on top of that land is an ancient pyramid, where Atum then stands and creates eight other gods. But notice here, what are the things that you see that are similar? Well, they're waters, right? You have land emerging out of water, and you have one god creating other gods. Okay. But in this case, the thing that really jumps out is that there is, like, this god, the creator god, had a beginning, correct? Did this creator god always exist? No, he came from this non-existent place of the waters and almost caused himself to come into existence. Are you with me?
Yes.
A little bit? Okay, all right. So there's Egypt, ladies and gentlemen. And this is a rabbit hole that has no end. They came with the dinosaurs. Okay, so we'll get to the aliens, yes. So good. That's funny. That's so good. All right, here's a Babylonian account. This is called the Enuma Elish, and it's very, very well known. In it gets referenced a lot because it does have some similarities to the Genesis 1 account. Enuma Elish, it's titled after the first two words in the Akkadian language. So God bless us. It starts, when on high no name was given to heaven, nor below was the netherworld called by name, primeval Apsu, the salty water, the deep abyss, was their beginner. And creator Tiamat, who is the salty ocean, was she who bore them all. They, Tiamat and Apsu, were mingling their waters together in a reproductive act. When no gods at all had been brought forth, none were called by names, none destinies ordained. They were the gods, then were the gods formed within these two. All right, stick with me. Here's what's being said here. In the beginning were waters. Have we heard this before?
Yes.
Fresh water, salt water, both represented by deities. The deities weren't like the god of water or the god of fresh water, but they were the waters. Okay, the deities were the waters, the fresh water and the salt water. They commingle together and create gods. They create, I think it's eight initially. Apsu, who is the kind of freshwater god is very annoyed, I kid you not, by how much noise the other gods make, and so he determines to kill them. Parents. Tiamat, the other goddess, opposes her husband's plan to kill her children. And so she, one of her children named Ea, E-A, literally slays Apsu. Apsu then, and then Ea gives birth to a demigod called Marduk. Marduk takes revenge on Tiamat, the mother, by cutting her in half. He uses wind as a weapon against her, and the wind forces her mouth open because she's taken the form of a great sea dragon. He shoots arrows down into her throat to kill her, and then he splits her into the heavens above and the earth below. And then out of her blood, he forms humanity. Absolutely. Totally sounds like a Greek mythology. You bet. So, are you with me a little bit on this? Okay, it's so odd. And I'm sorry I keep asking. I'm very secure in what I'm presenting. I'm not asking you to make me okay. What I'm asking is, this is thick stuff, and I want to make sure I'm explaining it well enough, because there's a point that's on the horizon about Elohim when we look at these two accounts. All right? There's also an account, and God bless me for not making you read this, of Israel's Canaanite neighbors who, the Baals, there's the storm god named Baal who goes to war with a watery dragon called Yam, Y-A-M, that we read about in the Old Testament. So there are these common themes kind of throughout the ancient Near East, and they help us a little in some ways understand what Genesis is doing. But there are also some big differences between what Genesis is doing and what was being said about the gods in the other places. So for instance, notice in Genesis, there is no, that's right, good Sarah, thank you. There's no theogony. A theogony is a birth story of the gods. Does Yahweh come from anywhere? Right? Did Yahweh always exist? Yes, in the beginning, God, period. Right? No backstory, no birth story. In the beginning, God. Now this really makes Elohim in this instance stand out. There's no theomachy. Theomachy, theo is God, machy is battle or fist fight. In a lot of the Babylonian narratives, they all involve conflict. Right? So here's this god slaughtering this god. Even in the Canaanite narratives of Baal and Yam, right, there's always battle. Is there any battle in Genesis? No. There's nothing. I mean, Yahweh is, and again, it's Elohim here. I'm sorry. I keep switching between the two. But Elohim here is totally unopposed, correct? There's no rival. There's no competitor. There's no battle. There is nothing. In the beginning, God. There's no pantheism here. Pantheism is when the literally the God and the material substance are the same thing. There's no pantheism. Elohim is totally separate from the created world. Right? He stands over the created world supremely, without rival or peer. And also, if you read the other accounts, like one of the ways in the Egyptian account, one of the ways Atum creates the other gods is with bodily fluids, spit and others. And it's gross and weird, but it's totally anthropomorphic. It's totally just, hey, let's look at how human beings do this and apply it to what the gods are like. Do we get that from Elohim? No. In the beginning, God. Not only that, but there's no other deity anywhere to be found, right? Elohim comes across as totally self-sufficient, totally contained in himself, not needing anything, not wanting anything, didn't create because he was lonely, didn't create because he was sad. He just, in the beginning, is. And when you look at what Yahweh means, when you look at it, the personal name Yahweh, it just means to exist. In the beginning, he existed. It's beautiful. So we get this incredible picture of a God without rival, without peer, without sadness or fear, without complaint or conflict. Elohim, in the beginning, God, and we take a deep breath and then read the rest of the story. You and I weren't doing much that day. In the beginning, God. Now, and the way this God works is so beautiful. All right, do you guys have one more piece of complicated information in you? Okay, let's meet the Jussive. Okay? So you can give commands directly. Hey, Nate, my son, clean your room. That is a direct command. An indirect command is, hey, son, would you clean up your room for me? They're both commands, but they carry different force. Would you agree? Yeah. So, I mean, oh, Kevin's like, no, actually they don't. I don't mean force in that way. But there is a way of talking about, and it's not just in Hebrew, it's in English. But when you get to God saying things like, let there be light, it carries this indirect force. It's not like light exists. It's jussive, which means it's almost invitational. Light, come forth. Like, the picture we get of Elohim's power, just from this word, let, is of a God who isn't domineering or bloodthirsty or like abusing power. It's a God who invites almost the light's participation coming forth. It's a command for sure, because Elohim is all powerful, but it's not a direct command. It's an invitation. So if I were to say tonight at the college cookout, let the food come forth, you would think that's a really weird way to talk. And it sounds like you think you're a king or something. But like, is it a command? Yes. But there's an invitational aspect to it. Are you with me on this point? So even when Elohim expresses power, even that's done in a way that's different from the ways the brute force creator gods of the other accounts would use their power. And as we see, like, Yahweh's not afraid to give his power away, as we'll see when he creates human beings. That's the thing that's so shocking, is that Yahweh delegates his power and is not afraid to do that. So even here in just let the light come forth, you get a glimpse of the kind of God that Yahweh is. Now, if you're thinking, Mike, this isn't really fascinating, but thank you. I've always wondered what Enuma Elish read like in Akkadian. Why in the world will we spend any time on this? Well, first, I want to honor the pause, because we're all about pause patrol. Here, come on. So dumb. I know. That's not going to get to the 11, okay? That's just a 9 o'clock special. No, I didn't. That just happened. Let a dad joke come forth. What are people who believe there is a flat earth afraid of? Sphere itself. Let laughter come forth. What? No. There is a storehouse. Have you seen where God keeps the hail? I have a similar storehouse. No. Good Lord. Why? Okay, what were we talking about? Why does this matter? Okay. When I stand up, you know it's serious. All right? There's a sense in which American Christianity has taken on a thoroughly self-individual absorbed kind of form. Like, I'm watching... I've not been on Instagram for years, and God bless Instagram, but I'm back on it, and I'm bombarded with snippets of sermons, and I love a good sermon, man. It's what I do, and I've preached some horrible sermons, so I have no desire to ever, like, critique other preachers, because I know, it's not the easiest thing in the world, But I was struck by how many of them are fishing in the same ballpark of, here's how you unlock your dreams. Here's how you find the doors of your destiny. Here's how you maximize who God created you to be. And they're all of those things, all of that thinking has what in common? Yeah. And so I'm sitting with the weight of Elohim and just how the Bible presents him. In the beginning, God. And I'm reminded of this speech that Paul gives in Acts 17, where he ruminates on what God is like from the Genesis account. So if you remember, he's in Athens. He's preaching the strange thing called the resurrection, and so he gets called up in front of this like council that would examine new teachings that came into the city. And so he stands up and he says, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious." Now, there are some ancient historians who would say that there were more statues of gods and goddesses than there were people in the city. So in every way, they were very religious. "I even found an altar with this inscription to an unknown god." They were so religious that they had an extra statue in case they missed one. And so Paul, genius, "Hey, I want to share with you what was unknown. I want to proclaim this to you next. So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship. And this is what I'm going to proclaim to you." Now, he's talking to Stoics and Epicureans. And I wish, this is a master class on dismantling the assumptions of Stoics and Epicureans. It's absolutely genius. But just notice some of how, you may have to check your paddles. Pedals? Are those pedals? Let me just say, speaking of paddles, Tim Timmons and I showed up at the Williamson County Rec Center on Wednesday morning playing pickleball, and those old ladies, we were very intimidated by how good they were. We kind of thought, hey, you know, we're great guys, we're athletes, we have paddles. Okay, I'm sorry. This is a masterclass on what Elohim means, okay, right here. So he's looking at this. He says, the singular God who made the world, and just so we're clear, everything in it, is the Lord. Lord here is Kurios. It means master, owner, possessor. He is the Lord of heaven and earth. And he does not live in your puny temples built by human hands. I mean, guys, you talk about a thesis statement. The singular God of everything, he is the owner and master of it all, and he doesn't live in your temples. I love that. Next. "And he is not served by human hands." Oh, no, this word served is the word therapeuso. It's where we get the word therapy. It's the picture of God doesn't need our help. He's not depressed. He's not anxious. He doesn't need our therapy. He doesn't need our worship. He doesn't need our sacrifices. He doesn't need our obedience. He doesn't need us to glorify him. It's like when Jesus comes strolling into Jerusalem and he's like, "Hey, even the rocks will cry out, ladies and gentlemen, if you're not going to." Right? That's the picture. This singular God who made everything is the owner and possessor of it all, and he doesn't live in temples, and he's not therapied by your human hands. He's not lonely, he's not anxious, he's not afraid. He's not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives, and then notice the list. Life, how much does that leave out? Breath, how much does that leave out? And then just in case anything was left out, and everything else. So instead of a God who we see as needy, this is the God who gives everything. From one man, he made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he marked out their appointed times and history and the boundaries of their lands. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him. He wasn't lonely. He doesn't need us. And it's a shock if you really get that God into your head, that then that God invites human beings to partner. Then that God turns out to be interested in the numbers of the hairs in our head. Then that God wants covenant relationship with us. But there seems, at least for me, I don't know how this is for you, but every now and again, I just need to be reminded, in the beginning, God. Not me, not my dreams, my life, my goals, my comfort, my convenience, my significance, my purpose, my meaning. In the beginning, God. And all of those things that I just listed are fine things, but they're actually found if you grant the significance of the first half of the first sentence of the entire Bible. God isn't up there saying, hey, you, do great things for me. Like there's this whole evangelical pressure. I've got to do great things for God. Where does that come from? And that God's job is to equip you to do great things for him. Where are we ever commanded to do that? This is the command that jumps out to me. Let's Instagram this right here. Go ahead, Sarah, 1 Thessalonians. We urge you, brothers and sisters, to do so more and more. Make it your ambition to lead a what? You should mind your own business and work with your, yeah, this computer, that's hands, thumbs, just as we told you, so that your daily life may win the respect of outsiders, so that you will not be dependent on anybody. Does that sound like doing great things for God? God does great things for God. And sometimes he invites us into those things. Hallelujah. But the pressure is not on us to make our life count, to make a mark for the kingdom. He will do it. In the beginning, God. And I, as a beloved speck of dust, am honored to play a part, but it doesn't rest on me as if he needed anything. I think every now and again we get a picture of this jealous God who's like, you better glorify me, you better glorify me. And I just don't think that's how the text presents what God is actually like. Questions? For 9 minutes if you want. We don't have to. Anything stand out to you?
Church, from the school, and we never got the message of mind your own business, work hard, and just be good. That's all you got to do. That, I mean, that sounds so nice. I'm a little angry that this was in the Bible the whole time.
Well, I love, yeah, you, first of all, you're the best. And I do think, like, Paul uses very active imagery to talk about discipleship. Like, We're not talking about just being lazy or passive. I don't think that's what Jesus
right.
is talking about.
Right, right, right.
Like, but we're talking about removing the pressure
right,
to have to be great, significant, yeah. meaningful, or my life didn't count.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It sounds so nice to just work hard, be good, do good, and just mind your own business. Like, that sounds so nice. And that is not the pressure I've been feeling for 43 years.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And that comes everywhere, right? You've got to parent, you've got to grow kids God's way, you've got to run a business God's way, you've got to date God's way. And it's like, I'm all for the wisdom in those things, but there is this sense like it does rest on me to be like, the other thing I noticed on Instagram, and again, I'm an old guy talking about Instagram, so although like, I'd get it, okay? Roll your eyes, I got it. But all I get from Instagram, and maybe I'm clicking on the wrong things, are life hacks. Here's how you hack your metabolism, which I could use. Here's how you hack studies. Here's how you hack a website. I mean, like, as if the goal of human life were to be as efficient as possible.
Well, and it's absolutely never the message of mind your own business. Work
that's
hard.
The one that's jumping out to you. That's the one I'm hearing,
well,
yes.
It's just everything is in comparison to how everybody else
is
doing it.
Oh, that's so good.
Yeah, everything, how you succeed in school, work, business, raise your kids, life. It's all about, oh, you better be paying attention to the world.
Yeah,
pay
yeah.
attention to the world. And, you know, hold yourself to these expectations given by all the other people around you.
Yeah.
And I am really, like, upset that this was in the Bible the whole time. Okay, I'm done now. I'm going to sit with
No, the that's great. Jesus cast out the demons of whatever that is, right? I just remember being in college, and all I heard was about the great things God wanted to do through me. And that if I missed that, there was so much pressure on nailing God's will. And if I messed up who I married, or I messed up where I went to school, or I messed up, I mean, there was so much pressure. And I was angry too when I realized, oh, I'm not sure. Like, of course, I think some things are better than other things, no doubt. But that way of looking at the world, I don't think leads to really healthy and whole places. And I think it gives us kind of a warped view of God. Yes.
Hi. Okay, so I have two questions. I'll go really fast. The first is the scripture of go out into all the world and make disciples of all the nations, if you want to, like, because that seems like you're not minding your own business and you're not supposed to. And then the other one is, it seems like it's really easy to read the Bible wrong, so if you could just tell us how to do it without you, that would be great. Yeah.
Oh, okay. First of all, I love you. I just do. Oh, this is so much fun. So my job up here is not to teach you what to think. And I know, like, we get intellectual sometimes, and I have to war against just staying up in that space, because that's where kind of I live by personality. I want to cause wrestling. Because that's what Jesus seemed to do, right? His teaching, it didn't end the conversation. It sort of started them all over the place. And so I have no doubt there are many things that I'm not correct on. But I don't see my role in this community as trying to get everybody to agree with how I would see things. So I don't ever want anyone to feel like...
I think you're misunderstanding. I think you're doing a great job. So how do I do a great job on my own?
Oh, thank you.
Because that verse said we don't need anyone.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At the end of minding our own business.
Okay. Oh, I love that. Okay. if I were saying, okay, somebody said, I want to learn the Bible more. What do I do? So print out like the book of Mark, eliminate all the paragraph breaks and verse numbers, and then start reading it. And have a notebook and write down every question that comes up. Well, what's son of David mean and why does that matter? Who's son of Abraham and why does that matter? What's the gospel? What's repent mean? And place yourself as much as you can in trying to hear it for the first time. And you will have far more questions than you do the Bible at that point, right? And then find somebody who will be a co-learner with you in working on, hey, what are these things? Because there are zillions of references that are out there that are incredible that will help. So I don't think the goal is ever to be someone who can do it by themselves. I think we read and understand the Bible best in community. But that's where I would start. About the disciples, How did the early church go and make disciples? Well, there were some that went and proclaimed. And then there's this whole, then we have letters to all the people who received the proclamation to just be faithful in the context they were in and be the church. And that it was the church's role to make disciples of all the nations. And so I think, I don't see the two commands as opposed at all. I think if the church provided a transformative narrative that counters the narratives of our age, I think that's a pretty powerful witness about the truth of Christian discipleship. I think what isn't always a great pointer to the truth of Christian discipleship is a bunch of people talking about life change they haven't really experienced because they feel pressured to rescue people from hell. Does that make sense? So, this is so great. So, what Jesus is inviting us into is a way of looking at the world. And that way of looking at the world, when we walk in partnership with the Spirit of Christ in us, transforms us. So, he's not inviting us into a doctrinal statement. He's inviting you, in your real life, to see the work of Elohim and Jesus all around you, so that instead of going through life feeling pressure to be great, you go through life being thankful that it's, because it's all a gift, right? I wasn't entitled to anything today. I just am thankful. Does that make sense? So the leading a quiet life, minding your own business, is I'm more concerned with becoming Christ-like than I am with being effective for Christ. Does that make sense? And I would argue that, especially today, is the much greater witness. I think we do. There are times, absolutely, we speak and proclaim, absolutely. But we've so overemphasized that part that many of the things that we speak and proclaim, we haven't really experienced ourselves. So you will hear people talk about the joy of the Lord, and they don't really experience that. Or they'll talk about how, you know, Jesus has totally delivered me from something, and then you find out they're still wrestling with it, and that's why they preach against it so hard. You know what I mean? So I just think there's an alignment there about being the church that we miss, that, you know, we want to kind of recapture. Does that help? Okay. One more maybe? Yeah.
Okay, I guess we're good.
You pretty much answered what I was just going to say about that tension between, like, this quiet life and minding your own business and also spreading the good news, which is in the Bible where it says be ready to give testimony whenever you're asked. Yeah. But you're saying actually let your actions speak louder than your words is what I
well,
am
notice,
thinking.
Notice, well, yes, but I think it's something deeper than that. Like, so Peter's writing to churches, and he says, set apart, before he even gets in to give an answer, set apart Christ as Lord. And I think that's the part, I think, where we miss, that the role of the community is to embody a community where Jesus actually is Lord over that community. And when people ask, with gentleness and respect, to give an answer, utterly and absolutely, I'm all for that part. No question about it. But what's the provoking of the question? Is it my conversational zinger about where they're going to go when they die? Or is it like that there's an uncommon life being lived by this community that has won the respect of outsiders? And it won't always, because we're always in tension with the world in some really dramatic respects. But there are other ways we provide a refreshing counter-narrative. Imagine a group of people who decided they wanted to be excellent at whatever they're doing in order to honor God, not because they needed to be great. Like, that's a whole different thing. Mm-hmm. I hope that's helpful.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to invite Susie and the band up. I'm going to pray. So we're just going to open it up. We're going to do our, we're going to spend some time going to the table, going to the prayer stations, worshiping, and go ahead. And I just want to close us in prayer. Jesus, we are so honored to be just reminded of our dispensability in some way. Jesus, we're so honored to be reminded that you don't need us and yet invite us and want us and pursue us and chase after us. Jesus, help us to live in this beautiful tension between being obedient and wanting to see you move in the world and yet also not feeling the pressure of having that rest on us. And so, God, we just want to pause this morning and just say, in the beginning, God. We want to pause and just reflect on how glorious and majestic you are. Amen.